Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Impatience and pain across this country. The number of unemployed, the number of cases, and the death toll from coronavirus continues to rise.
This is worse than Pearl Harbor. This is worse than the World Trade Center. There's never been an attack like this, and it should have never happened.
The Justice Department dropped its case against former Trump aide Michael Flynn, despite him pleading guilty twice. Attorney General Bill Barr spoke to CBS News.
A crime cannot be established here. They did not have a basis for a counterintelligence investigation against Flynn at that stage.
Does the fact remain that he lied?
Well, you know, people sometimes plead to things that turn out not to be crimes.
Today would have been Ahmaud Arbery's 26th birthday. The two men who shot and killed him in Georgia are now behind bars. His sister Jasmine says the family wants justice.
This whole situation was senseless. It could have been avoided. Our brother's supposed to be here.
It is our Week in the News roundtable, and we have a great panel today. With me from Boston is Rick Burke. He's co-founder and executive editor of STAT, a media company focused on health, medicine, and science. Rick, great to have you back on Point.
Thanks, Jane. Good to be here.
From Washington, Paula Reed. She's White House correspondent at CBS News. Paula, welcome back to you.
Thank you so much.
And Amara Omakwe. She joins us from Washington. She's an economics reporter at The Wall Street Journal, covering the impact of coronavirus on small businesses. Amara, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the news that the Justice Department has dropped its case against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. President Trump said he was considering a pardon of Flynn. He said that many times, but Attorney General Bill Barr abruptly ended it all by dropping the case. Paula Reed, what is the significance of this?
It's incredibly significant, especially all the resources, time and attention that's being focused on this one case amid historic unemployment and an international pandemic. So a lot of questions about why this and why now. There does not appear, based on my conversations with folks who have worked as federal prosecutors, defense attorneys, there does not appear to be a precedent for this. As you noted, he has pleaded guilty twice. General Flynn. He has also cooperated with investigators. And now for the Justice Department to withdraw this case, arguing that they could no longer prove it before a jury. There are a lot of questions right now about political interference, about why they're doing this now. But the big question I'm watching is, what does this mean for the FBI director, for Chris Wray? Because what I've noticed over the past week is every time this case comes up, the president's allies, White House officials like Kellyanne Conway, even the president himself today, they all bring up the FBI director, which is odd because most of this happened under former FBI director James Comey. Mm-hmm. Chris Wray has been there during the internal watchdog reviews that have examined the Russia investigation, but he's not personally responsible for this. But the president today made it clear his FBI director is on thin ice. And what I'm watching, what I'm asking today is this whole Mike Flynn incident, is trying to bring attention to this, is this pretext to try to fire Chris Wray?
Well, the question that many people have asked all along is, if Michael Flynn did nothing wrong when he called the Russian ambassador back in December 2016, right? It was the same day President Obama imposed sanctions on Russia for interfering with the presidential election. So if he did nothing wrong, why did he conceal that and the significance of this now with that information?
And why did he plead guilty to initially lying to investigators? Not once, but twice. Why did he cooperate? Why did he engage in this deal? I mean, he out there was the possibility of a presidential pardon. We saw other people in this investigation, for example, Paul Manafort, who spent a lot of money to fight these charges, knowing he would likely be convicted, but hoping that if he fought, if he didn't cooperate, that there would be a presidential pardon on the other side. So there are so many questions right now that just remain unanswered about why Mike Flynn did what he did, why he lied and why he pleaded guilty to lying, why he continued to cooperate, but then now, years later, starts to fight this case. And also there's some selective release of the documents in this case. On the one hand, the Trump administration is trying to block materials from the Mueller grand jury from getting out, while sort of selectively releasing things, for example, the notes from the FBI investigators here. Traditionally, the notes that have been released, you know, the questions about what are we trying to get Flynn to do here, those to a lot of people, those didn't pass the smell test, but they're not out of bounds of the kind of techniques the FBI uses. And traditionally, that kind of stuff is not passed over to defense attorneys. So a lot of questions about whether the administration, the Trump Justice Department, is selectively leaking certain materials to help craft this narrative to undermine the legitimacy of the Russia investigation and perhaps some current justice officials.
Paula Reed, thank you. Let me turn now to the news today, the grim and stunning unemployment numbers as the coronavirus rolls on in the United States. 3.2 million people filed for unemployment last week. We're now at 33 million Americans who have applied for unemployment benefits over the last 7 weeks. That is a catastrophic collapse of the U.S. economy. Amara, are we at the bottom here? Is the bottom in sight?
Well, economists are really kind of divided on that question. It really is going to depend on how soon the economy reopens, how soon social distancing measures are kind of eased. And that will really determine, you know, the shape of the recovery and how deep the recovery is. We have had many Americans file for unemployment. We also got the jobs report this morning showing that the unemployment rate rose to 14.7% last month. That's the highest on record going back to 1948, according to the Labor Department. So it really is stunning just how much the coronavirus is impacting the economy. And really, the unemployment losses were really broad-based. As we would expect, we saw losses in leisure and hospitality because of social distancing measures, but also in healthcare, retail, professional services. So it really is widespread losses across the economy.
Right. For an economy that was on fire 2 months ago when we had the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. Do you see these jobs coming back, Amara?
Economists say that in the hardest hit industries, it probably will take a while for the jobs to come back. But again, they're saying that it really does depend on how soon the economy reopens and when Americans really feel comfortable sort of spending money again. Because, of course, just because the economy reopens doesn't mean that consumers will necessarily have the confidence to spend money after we've seen such a drop in the economy over these last few weeks.
Mm. Rick Burke.
I'm just wondering if these numbers are even much worse than we know, because when you think about all the workers who have had their hours cut or their pay slashed, I mean, it just seems like we're only getting part of the picture. And it's all the more disconcerting or dissonant when you see Trump was on Fox this morning saying, we're going to have a phenomenal year next year in terms of the economy. And it's just hard to absorb what we're hearing from the White House and looking at these numbers, which probably are even worse.
Mm. Rick Burke, talk about the projections that the Centers for Disease Control put out this week. This is their modeling some stunning numbers about the impact of the coronavirus. The CDC is saying about 200,000 daily cases by July. That's up from 25,000 right now. What did you see this week in those projections, Rick?
Well, there have been so many models and projections. I would say let's just look at the facts as today, as we're seeing them. And it's stunning. Like, we at STAT have like a tracker that shows the worldwide infections and deaths in the U.S. every day, as do other news organizations. But you just look at these are people dying. And if you look at the numbers right now, the U.S. confirmed more than 25,000 new cases, new infections every day in April. And that clip doesn't seem to be dropping this month. And more than, if you look at the numbers, more than 1,000 people have died every day since April 2nd. On some days, including Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, the toll was up to 2,000. So there's all this talk of a second wave hitting the U.S. this fall, but we're not over with this first wave. Mm. And And we don't know where it's going. There have been already in this country way over 75,000 deaths. So you can look, Paul, at these different projections, but the reality is, to me, something we need to just face up to right now.
So an interesting development this week. The White House rejected the Centers for Disease Control's detailed reopening guide. Paula Reed, this was a step-by-step guide for business owners, educators, faith leaders, state and local officials to help them essentially, you know, how to open up, when to open up, you know, public places. Tell us what was behind the White House shelving of this CDC document, Paula.
Well, as you noted, this was researched, it was compiled into a document, but then it was shelved. And the official explanation is that the administration didn't want to provide, quote, mixed messages to state and local leaders as they attempt to reopen. Now, as I understand it, talking to my sources, that's they're arguing it is sort of federalism. They're saying we're going to let the states figure this out. We don't want to be giving them federal guidelines. But wait a second, that's what they've been doing throughout this entire crisis. And most states don't have the resources and expertise of the Centers for Disease Control. That's why we have it. Now, this is taxpayer-funded research. And at this point, the administration has not been able to explain who specifically decided that this should not be released and why taxpayers are not able to get the benefit of this research and of this guidance that they paid for. State and local leaders don't necessarily have to accept it, but definitely a lot of questions right now for the administration about why not release this. There have been some concerns raised about how this could impact religious services, for example, but it's pretty easy to just put in a caveat, put in a waiver. Very unusual, and it's been an abrupt shift with this White House from going from issuing federal guidelines with specific timelines to not wanting to even release any guidelines from the experts at the CDC as the White House pushes state and local leaders to get back to business and reopen their states, towns, and societies. Mm.
Rick, about 10 seconds. What did you see there from a health perspective, the White House calling this guide too uniform, too regressive, too prescriptive?
Jane, I see this as just a larger issue with the CDC being sidelined throughout this whole pandemic. The CDC should be front and center. Redfield, the director, should be out there, and they should be giving guidance to the country. And they're barely recognized and barely have a public profile. And I think that's part of the problem.
We're talking all things COVID-19, the virus, the government response, the effort to restart the economy, much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the week in the news. And with us, Rick Burke from Stat News, Paula Reed from CBS News, and Amara Omakwe from The Wall Street Journal. This week, President Trump said that the White House task force leading his administration's coronavirus response would be shut down and replaced with a group focused on reopening the economy. Here's President Trump.
I think that as far as the task force, Mike Pence and the task force have done a great job, but we're now looking at a little bit of a different form, and that form is safety and opening, and we'll have a different group probably set up for that.
Are you saying mission accomplished?
No, not at all. The mission accomplished is when it's over. When it's over, Jim, mission accomplished. No.
I understand you don't want to keep the country closed for 5 years, but don't you want your advisors to keep looking at this closely the way
well,
you
they
have?
They are looking at it very closely. They are looking at it very closely.
And then a day later on Wednesday, President Trump reversed course and said he would keep the task force.
I thought we could wind it down sooner, but I had no idea how popular the task force is until actually yesterday. When I started talking about winding it down, I'd get calls from very respected people saying, I think it would be better to keep it going. It's done such a good job. It's a respected task force. It's I knew it myself. I didn't know whether or not it was appreciated by the public, but it is appreciated by the public. I mean, you look at the job we've done on everything.
Paula Reed, why the about face? Why the change?
You know, I don't even know if there ever was a change. I can tell you that day. So the day before, Vice President Mike Pence had an off-camera briefing for some reporters. He told these reporters that he had had discussions about winding things down. Shortly thereafter, the president was asked about this. You just played the clip. But around that time, I called Dr. Anthony Fauci and I said, hey, what's going on with the task force? He said he had heard nothing about disbanding the task force. So the next day, the president basically confirmed what Dr. Fauci had told me in real time, which is now the task force isn't going anywhere. It appears it might have been a trial balloon. But again, if you haven't discussed this with Dr. Anthony Fauci, I mean, was it something they were seriously thinking of doing? Was it a political calculation where they didn't feel the need to actually talk to their top health expert? It's unclear, but it kind of shows you once again in the White House, when you get a lot of mixed messages, you can usually look to Dr. Anthony Fauci for the best, most accurate information.
Amara, what did you hear in that shift?
I wasn't really following that. What I do know is that a lot of this question about reopening is really a question of how it's going to be carried out and how that will ultimately impact the economy. Some lawmakers have been arguing that you can spend all you want on aid, on providing stimulus checks to Americans, on providing small relief to businesses, providing relief to businesses, but really you're not going to see Americans feel economic relief until the economy reopens. And that raises all sorts of questions about what kind of testing levels are needed, what opening procedures should be like, and what's going to make Americans feel comfortable going out again and opening their wallets.
So U.S. senators went back to work this week. Amira, maybe a better question for you is, are you expecting another emergency relief package on their agenda?
They're talking about that now. Our congressional team at the Journal is reporting that Democrats in the House are close to finalizing their next legislative response to the coronavirus. And lawmakers in Washington are kind of setting their red lines about what they would like to see in a next package. We also have a lot of lawmakers talking about what businesses and what the economy will need as things start to reopen. And they're really focusing on small businesses in particular and what kinds of things will allow them to kind of stay solvent and be able to reopen here in as the virus kind of recedes.
Mm-hmm. Some lawmakers wanted to wrap up the Paycheck Protection Program, Paula Reed. Others wanted to modify it because in many cases it's not really working. It's not meeting people's needs. What is working and what is not working with the Paycheck Protection Program at this point, especially for small businesses?
Sure. So you hear mixed messages. On the one hand, the White House says it was a tremendous success. It ran out of money. It was doing great. They had to do a second phase. It was so successful. But there have been a lot of problems. There were a lot of questions about why really big businesses with a lot of money were receiving money. We saw, you know, some pretty famous franchises sort of be shamed in to returning the stimulus money or the extra relief money that they received. A lot of small businesses say, though, that either they weren't able to get through, they weren't able to get money before it dried up, or if they were, it wasn't exactly what they needed. It's also complicated because once you accept this, you can't lay people off. Sometimes employees would get frustrated that they couldn't get unemployment. So look, sources inside the White House always tell me, they say this was passed with record speed and it's a record size. And they really had to work out a lot of the details on the fly. Now, I do think there is more of an appetite here at the White House to help businesses, but the president is getting enormous pressure from outside conservative business leaders not to do another massive $1 trillion economic stimulus. Instead, the message he's getting is to try to reopen businesses, even as corona cases increase, to get America back to work and to roll back regulations. Now, you've also heard the president say that he's interested in doing a payroll tax cut. My colleague here, she can probably tell you that on the Hill, there's not a lot of appetite for that. It's thought that it wouldn't necessarily address those who have been negatively impacted by coronavirus. There's also been talk of infrastructure, but it's not quite clear how the president's talk of infrastructure directly corresponds to coronavirus. So I can tell you right here from the White House, it's not clear what a phase four stimulus deal looks like. But you know, the president is getting a lot of pressure not to sign another big check.
We got a lot of listener reaction to this. Anthony in Dayton, Ohio is self-employed. He has been waiting for his unemployment benefits or any assistance really from the government since his business was shut down in March. Here's what he told us about that in a voicemail.
It really makes you wonder if it's intentional that we just break down and go and get jobs, which will disqualify us from unemployment. It's impossible to get through to Governor DeWine's office. There are many, many people who are self-employed, 1099 sole proprietors, who need some assistance.
Amira, the PPP's first $350 billion was quickly exhausted, and most of the additional $320 billion has already been used. It really seems, I mean, there's Anthony who's still waiting. This is a much larger and more systemic crisis than the PPP was designed for, Amira.
That's right. Absolutely. It was. And even the people, the lawmakers and the administration officials who worked on it have been open about that. The PPP program was meant to be a temporary sort of lifeline to businesses. And that's why a lot of lawmakers are now saying, okay, what else do we need to do? Do we need to do more stimulus checks to households? Do we need to give American businesses direct cash grants, just put money in their hands so that they can stay alive, essentially? And for sole proprietors and independent contractors in particular, a lot of these programs have been hard to access. For instance, with PPP, sole proprietors and independent contractors weren't able to even apply until a full week after other businesses. So we have heard a lot of frustrations from people who are just sort of running the tiniest of tiny businesses in America.
So there's an interesting question that Congress has to grapple with, and that is loan forgiveness. What are the rules about spending this loan money, Amira, and does it need to be paid back?
So the Paycheck Protection Program was designed to offer forgivable loans. But after the law was sort of written and signed, the administration sort of imposed this requirement that businesses spend at least 75% of the money on payroll if they want the loans to be fully forgiven. And that requirement is proving difficult for some businesses because of social distancing measures and state mandated closures. Businesses are saying, how can I bring my workers back? What would they even be doing when I have no customers? I have no business. So a lot of small business advocacy groups and businesses are pushing for that requirement to be relaxed because the last thing they want to see is these businesses not be able to meet those forgiveness requirements and then have what was supposed to be a forgivable loan turn into an actual loan that needs to be repaid.
Mm-hmm. Well, in other news this week, one of President Trump's personal valets, one of his military aides, tested positive for coronavirus yesterday. The aide is now in quarantine. This aide performed personal tasks for the president in close proximity to the president, including serving his meals. Paula Reid, the president will now be tested daily for coronavirus instead of weekly because of these interactions. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And that's a stark contrast to the experience of most Americans who have difficulty getting a test, even as the president, you know, pushes the country to reopen. Now, we got some more news when the president spoke with Fox and Friends earlier. He revealed that, in fact, he was in the Oval Office with this individual on Tuesday. And Tuesday is a significant date because that's the day that this valet started exhibiting symptoms. So now we have the president of the United States, if you've been in the Oval Office, it's pretty small, in a small room with someone who is positive and exhibiting symptoms. So a lot of questions now about what measures will the White House take. The president said that folks who bring him food now, they will wear facial coverings. But the big question is, why haven't they been doing this all along? I've been wandering around the West Wing for months now. Nobody back there wears masks.
Rick,
nobody really socially distanced.
Right.
Why now?
Right.
Take this?
And Rick Burke, the president, is the ultimate essential employee, right? But should he be following his own White House guidelines and quarantining for 14 days, following his own protocol, Rick?
he should be following his own protocol and also setting an example for the country. I mean, you saw him out and about without a face mask, meeting workers the other day when he went on that trip. You saw Vice President Pence be criticized for the same thing. They need to set an example, and it gives you the sense that they don't really take this as seriously as they should.
Well, speaking of wearing masks, this week, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, who's been applauded for his COVID response, reversed his decision on requiring people to wear masks in retail establishments.
It became very clear to me after we put out the order that everyone in retail who walked into a store as a customer would have to do that. It became clear to me that that was just a bridge too far, that people were not going to accept the government telling them what to do. And so we put out, you know, dozens and dozens of orders. That was one that it just went too far. But at the same time we pulled that back, I said, look, this is highly recommended. This is for most people, it's unless you've got a physical reason, you can't wear the mask. And we understand that. But when you go into a retail store, that is the kind thing to do.
Governor DeWine, they're saying, well, this is a bridge too far for many of my folks. What did you make of that reversal, Rick Burke?
I thought that, again, that's a real contrast to what we were just talking about with the president. DeWine has been one of the most aggressive governors out there saying this is serious. Take this serious. We've got to protect our citizens. And I think what happened here is there were people pushing back, saying we don't need the government telling us what to do. And you've gone too far. And so he relented. But I think it's the push and tug about, you know, how far can the government go in telling you what to do? But I think his heart was in the right place. And he's even gotten some pushback from some people saying, you're not protecting us. You shouldn't have rescinded that.
And the truth is, Rick, that deaths and infection rates outside of New York State are still rising, even as states move to lift their lockdowns, Rick.
Yeah, it's not coming down. In fact, they're increasing in some areas. Texas in the last few days has reported more new cases than it did in mid-April. Cases are accelerating in Kansas. Outbreaks are building in processing plants, meat processing plants, and prisons. So they're down in some high-profile places like New York. The Bay Area's early shelter-in-place efforts appear to have helped and reduced the numbers there. But this is far from over.
I want to play this clip. It was an interesting Fox News town hall at the Lincoln Memorial when the president scaled up the estimates that he has used for the number of projected dead. He then went on to answer a question with a statue of Abraham Lincoln in the background, a question from a retired nurse, an elementary school guidance counselor named Carolyn Perkins. She asked the president why he used words that sounded like bullying when talking to the press.
Look, I am greeted with a hostile press, the likes of which no president has ever seen. The closest would be that gentleman right up there. They always said Lincoln. Nobody got treated worse than Lincoln. I believe I am treated worse.
Paula Reid, talk about the president and sort of this recurring theme in the midst of the pandemic. On the one hand, talking about his treatment by the press, and on the other hand, talking about, you know, how to sort of handle the coronavirus.
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak to my own experience in this in the briefing. If you ask the president, for example, you know, what did you do in the month of February to prepare hospitals? And he turns around and he issues it, lobs a personal insult. Well, that is your answer. Really, this can be a tactic. People say there's a tactic. The president's base loves it. I can't speak to that because right now, tens of thousands of Americans are dead. Tens of millions of Americans are unemployed. If you are asked a substantive question about the coronavirus and all you've got is attacks on the media, that's your answer. That's your message to voters about your record. And while it's a sort of a shtick that works at campaign rallies and in front of very sympathetic audiences, it's not clear that's really what the moment calls for right now. And it's unclear how that's going to resonate with voters, including his supporters.
The president also said this week, quote, the people of our country should think of themselves as warriors. We have to open. So, Amira, this debate between, you know, economic despair that so many people are feeling and the loss of life, on the other hand, continues, Amira.
It's true, it does. But at the end of the day, those that are pushing for reopening, they're arguing that what is ailing the economy is the fact that it is not open. And the only way to really provide Americans economic relief is to gradually start to reopen things. Another thing that some lawmakers, particularly on the Republican side, have been raising is the debt and what it will take to kind of finance all these various aid programs that that Congress has put in place over these past few weeks to address this crisis. Some are just arguing that what should happen really is Mitch McConnell, for instance, has said there should be a pause in future aid programs as we see sort of how what Congress has already put in place kind of filters through the economy. Mm-hmm.
Let me end before we go to break here with this clip from former President George W. Bush. He released a video on Sunday calling on Americans to unite during this crisis.
Let us remember we have faced times of testing before. Following 9/11, I saw a great nation rise as one to honor the brave, to grieve with the grieving, and to embrace unavoidable new duties. And I have no doubt, none at all, that this spirit of service and sacrifice is alive and well in America. Second, let us remember that empathy and simple kindness are essential, powerful tools of national recovery.
Paula Reed, about 15 seconds here before the break. Your thoughts on this call for unity and the president's response?
Well, the president's response was to criticize the former president for not speaking up while President Trump was going through impeachment hearings. That's pretty much all you need to know about what President Trump thinks of the former president's approach.
We are discussing the week in the news. Paula Reed, Amira Amakwe, and Rick Burke. Stick with us. Much more to come. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We will be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. On Monday, we're going to be talking about states that are reopening, where you can get a haircut, get your nails done, maybe even go to a restaurant. Are things reopening where you are? Are people responding to the lifting of staying home orders? Tell us what change is like for you and your community. We'd love to hear from you in a voicemail, 617-353-0683. Now we continue with our weekly news roundtable. Our panel this hour, Rick Burke of Stat News, Paula Reed of CBS News, and Amira Amakwe of The Wall Street Journal. Important story out of Georgia this week. Two suspects were charged with murder in the shooting death of an unarmed 25-year-old black man, Ahmaud Arbery. He was killed in a quiet neighborhood about an hour south of Savannah. He was out on a run. He was exercising. The two men who killed him, a father and a son, told police that they had driven past Arbery, thought that he looked like a suspect in a string of break-ins around there, and went and grabbed guns, apparently, and drove back. And, you know, details are sketchy, but a scuffle ensued, and apparently he was shot. This story has gained national attention, Paula Reed, largely because graphic footage of the incident was posted on the internet 2 months after the shooting. Paula, tell us what you know about this.
So I can tell you, I have covered on the ground Trayvon Martin. I've covered Ferguson, Baltimore, so many other cities. I was on the ground for Charlottesville. I've covered these kinds of stories in the past. What's significant here, though, is we have this video. This is not a police-involved shooting. So legally speaking, it is a lot easier for the federal government to step in here. And we asked the White House yesterday if the president had seen the video. This morning, he confirmed that he watched the video. He called it, quote, very disturbing. And it was interesting. He said he'd seen a picture of Arbery. He said, quote, he was in a tuxedo. He looked like a very good young man. The president offered condolences to his parents and friends, but he was pressed on whether he would push for federal involvement in this case. And he appeared to defer to the state of Georgia. And that's significant because Georgia is one of a handful of states that does not have a hate crime law. And here there are legitimate questions about how the state has handled this so far. They've gone through a number of prosecutors. This happened several months ago. We're only getting arrests now. There are some questions for the administration about why not open a federal civil rights investigation, even if it's a belt and suspenders exercise along with the states. It's a question the president will continue to get. He and his administration have been haunted by his comments about Charlottesville, that there were good people on both sides. But we also have to remember in that case, they opened a civil rights investigation within 24 hours to some of the crimes that happened on the ground there. So it will be interesting to see how the Trump administration reacts to this case going forward.
What's your sense, Paula? What's your gut? Do you think a federal civil rights case will be opened?
If I was advising the president, I think that there's an open question about whether this is an opportunity, given that Georgia doesn't have a hate crime law. This is an opportunity to address the civil rights questions that are raised in that video. And while the president expected him to defer to the state has faced significant criticism for its handling of this case. This is definitely a gray area when it comes to whether the president can and should step in. And it seems that if he wanted to, he would have a pretty good case to make. Even if you defer to the states, look, belt and suspenders, we're going to look at this too. He will continue to get pressed on this. And I can tell you, I'm not sure exactly where he will ultimately land.
Thanks, Paula. Let's move to the Supreme Court. It was a very different Supreme Court this week because of the pandemic. The Supreme Court conducted oral arguments by telephone. Lawyers were unnerved, to say the least, because they couldn't read the justice's body language. Someone actually flushed a toilet in the middle of the back and forth, but arguments continued. And here's a clip, a moment from the Little Sisters of the Poor case, Little Sisters of the Poor versus Pennsylvania, with Solicitor General Noel Francisco and Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
The respondents haven't yet identified anyone who would actually lose access to contraception as a result of these rules. I think presumably because access to contraception is widely available in this country through many other means besides forcing your...
Let's go there. HHS decided that contraceptives were a preventive service required under the Act. Now you say it has to take care to both promulgate the Act and accommodate religious objections. But in your calculus, what you haven't considered or told me about is the effect on women who now have to go out, as Justice Ginsburg said, and search for contraceptive coverage if they can't personally afford it.
The court was hearing arguments in several cases dealing with religious organizations that want to ban contraceptives from their health care, from their health insurance policies. Rick Burke, the public has never before listened in real time to Supreme Court arguments. This was historic in many ways. What did you hear today, this week, from the Supreme Court?
I just think it's interesting seeing every part of society trying to deal with life under COVID, and how do we get back to life, or do we get back to normalcy? What is normal? What's the new normal? It's very confusing. I talked to a federal judge I know the other day who said he has not gotten any guidance from his bosses about resuming their work. So, I mean, he'll meet on Zoom with his law clerks every day, but there's no guidance in these cases. I'm not talking about the Supreme Court, but just on just cases around the country just piling up. And that's just the court system. So there's so many unknowns here, but when the country sort of grinds to a halt like this.
Speaking of court cases, a federal judge ordered officials in New York State, to restore a presidential primary that had been canceled over concerns about coronavirus. The judge said it was unconstitutional to cancel the vote. Paula Reed, explain why this was such a significant ruling and what it means looking forward toward November.
I'll be honest with you. I have not followed specifically this case just because there's been so much news at the White House. But I can tell you one of the questions we've been pressing the administration on is whether they have any plans to make sure that people have access to all of the election opportunities, all the voting opportunities that are coming between now and the big election in November. And so far, the administration has not been really willing to make too many concessions, not been really willing to push for paper ballots, for other opportunities to make sure that our elections here in the U.S. are protected, even as we go through this pandemic.
Well, during this pandemic, some interesting news from President Trump, who told reporters this week that he is committed to dismantling the Affordable Care Act. And then Attorney General Bill Barr said he wanted to adjust the administration's legal position.
Obamacare is a disaster, but we've run it very well. And we've made it barely acceptable. It was a disaster under President Obama, and it's very bad health care. What we want to do is terminate it and give great health care, and we'll have great health care, including pre-existing conditions, 100% pre-existing conditions.
Rick Burke, Bill Barr apparently privately arguing that parts of this law should be preserved amidst the pandemic. How might this impact people who might otherwise have lost health care because of a job loss during the pandemic or for other reasons, Rick?
Yeah, I can't see in the middle of a pandemic, I can't see this flying and I can't see this those people being affected. I think, if anything, the pandemic is sort of exhibit one of why people need to be taken care of. And in some ways, it sort of reminds you of why sort of what Bernie Sanders was talking about and sort of gives him credibility for some of his talk on the campaign trail during the primaries about the need for health care for all.
Reason for terminating this, Paula Reed, during a pandemic?
Well, that's been the big question. There's been a huge split in the administration over this long before coronavirus. Was this politically, legally, and from a humanitarian perspective, the best approach? And the attorney general tried to make the argument legally and, again, politically, that this was not the way you want to go, particularly when this wouldn't be heard until the fall, probably wouldn't be decided until close, if not after the election. The coronavirus aspect of this just really compounds the humanitarian toll that could result. But again, the president, he heard both sides and he seems resolute in his desire to continue to look for a full obliteration of Obamacare.
Amira, let me ask you about other news this week. Several states say that they will ask the Labor Department for $36 billion in federal advance money to cover the astronomical cost of unemployment benefits, unemployment payouts. Talk about this. I mean, you can add it to the tab of the federal government payouts. This is adding up and states need it.
States really do need it. I mean, more than 30 million Americans have applied, I think, as you noted, Jane, for unemployment benefits in over roughly the last 2 months. And states are just completely overwhelmed by this. A lot of their technology is old also, so they're trying to process a significant uptick in the number of unemployment insurance applications, as well as just dealing with the fact that so many people just need this help. So you can expect a lot of states, some states have already said that they're going to need help from the federal government to meet this demand, and you could expect that more states will say the same. Mm.
Illinois, California, Texas, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Ohio. I mean, you know, the list goes on. What about the homeowners, millions of homeowners and renters who are already behind on their payments, Amira? There's been an aggressive federal and state intervention to prevent evictions during this time, foreclosures across this country during this time. Still, I read this week a report that said 2 million homeowners could lose their homes to foreclosure because of the coronavirus pandemic. Amira, speak to that for just a moment.
Yeah, you have had a lot of mortgage lenders, you know, offer aid to homeowners, giving them deferment on payments and saying, you know, they're willing to work with people to sort of help them manage this crisis. But at the end of the day, we are seeing a lot of employment losses and we are seeing people lose their incomes. And until people are able to go back to work and we are able to restore some of these jobs that have been lost because of this pandemic, you're going to see people have issues like meeting their mortgages, meeting their credit card payments. So this is something that we'll definitely be watching.
Rick Burke, let me ask you quickly about this disturbing story this week about children across this country falling ill to coronavirus, an inflammatory syndrome thought to be linked to COVID. Numbers are somewhat small so far, but doctors say this is an important thing to watch, Rick.
Well, it's another example of like so many unknowns about COVID and what it could bring. As you said, it's a relatively tiny number of people, children who are affected, and most have responded well to treatment. And we're not sure it's COVID related. They think it might be, but we're not sure. And there are just more questions than answers on this. But it's yet one more sort of reverberation from COVID.
Rick, you wanted to mention a story that hit on Stat this week regarding the porn industry and how it's reacting to the COVID crisis.
Yeah, I think and don't roll your eyes, Jane, when I describe it. But I do think it's important. We have a story that came out today that talks about the porn industry and the experience of the industry over in the 90s in testing and being sort of a model for what the coronavirus public health officials are trying to go through right now. In the late 90s, when HIV infections threatened to shutter the entire multi-billion dollar porn industry, the community sort of implemented procedures that required performers to be tested for HIV and other disease and sexually transmitted diseases 14 days before they could go to work. And there were programs to protect thousands of performers, ensure safer workplaces. And we talked to a bunch of public health experts who say that's what the porn industry has done would be a great model for what needs to be done for coronavirus in terms of testing and geography, politics, science, the costs, workers' privacy. We're not expecting, you know, the Trump administration or governors to go run to the porn industry now to get advice, but it really wouldn't be a bad idea.
Hmm. All right, we'll watch that. Paula Reed, give us, as we end here, look ahead and give us some positive signs, something to look forward to, some green shoots that we can turn to in the week ahead. What's on your plate? What are you looking toward?
Well, definitely looking towards what the administration is going to do to continue to help folks who are unemployed in the next several months. I mean, these are historic job numbers that we're seeing. The economic devastation cannot be overstated. So curious to see if the president really does just look to things like infrastructure, rolling back regulations, if he's willing to just infuse money into the economy. That's really what I'm most with my reporting, really figuring out how they're going to help Americans economically through the next several months and what happens, of course, both on a human and economic level, if there is a resurgence. Mm.
Amira, what are you looking toward economically in the weeks ahead?
Pretty much the same thing. I think that although there is some disagreement in Congress about sort of what the next round of aid should look like, there is agreement that more needs to be done. And you're seeing lawmakers all the time come out with different proposals about what they think could sort of help Americans and help small businesses as the economy starts to reopen. So just continuing to look for that, and also continuing to look for how they're going to modify some of the aid that they've already put in place to make sure that aid is working as it was intended. Mm.
And Rick Burke, from a health perspective, health reporter, what are you seeing out there as we face the coronavirus for another week?
I think we're just seeing all the questions that we've talked about today about reopening when all these states, you know, 30 states have started to ease the lockdown restrictions. But in most of those states, there's still rampant infections and there's a real problem. So I think we're going to see the pull of reopening versus not reopening, all these economic questions and all these health questions that remain to be answered. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much to all of you for a great hour, a great panel. Rick Burke, co-founder and executive editor of Stat, as a media company focused on health, medicine, and science. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News. Paul, always great to have you. Thanks.
Oh, great to be here.
And Amira Amakwe, she is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on small businesses, among other things. Amira, thanks so much to you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer acute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Marotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.